streaming TV, home security, and automation in southern Indiana. More information at smithville.com. And from Bloomington Health Foundation, this September hosting the virtual 21st running of Hoosiers Outrun Cancer, a 5K run/walk supporting those in the community facing a cancer diagnosis. Registration and more at HoosiersOutrunCancer.org.
Welcome to Noon Edition. I'm Bob Zaltzberg from the WFIU-WTIU newsroom. I'll be co-hosting today with Sarah Whitmire, the WFIU-WTIU News Bureau Chief. We're recording the show remotely, and we have been since March to avoid the risk of spreading infection. Today, we're talking about coming updates to the NCAA's name, image, and likeness rules. And we have three guests with us who are joining us today. Galen Clavio is director of the National Sports Journalism Center, and he's a member of IU Athletics' Name, Image, and Likeness Task Force. Jeremy Gray is Senior Associate Athletic Director for Strategic Communications and the Director of the Cuban Center, and he's also a member of the task force. He's actually the co-chair of the task force. And Kenneth Dow Schmidt is a Willard and Margaret Carr Professor of Labor and Employment Law at the Maurer School of Law here in Bloomington. You can join us today with your questions by sending them to news@indianapublicmedia.org. And you can also follow us on Twitter at Noon Edition. So this is a great topic, and I want to get into it here in a minute. But first, I want to ask Jeremy Gray from the athletic department about the news of the week, which is the return of Big Ten football coming up at the end of October. What really led to the Big Ten being able to plan on a football season, Jeremy?
Well, first, thanks so much for having me, and it's an exciting week for the conference as football will be returning in late October. To your question, I think one of the things that is great about the Big Ten is a spirit of collaboration, and very quickly, maybe before any other conference, it was determined, you know, even prior to the fall postponement, that we would play a conference-only schedule. And a major reason for that is that there were daily calls with the commissioner and the athletic directors, as a matter of routine, conversations with the commissioner and the university presidents, the chief medical officers, and, you know, doctors associated with each of the 14 institutions, in regular communication with one another. One, monitoring the situation, understanding what other institutions were doing, and, you know, coalescing around a series of guidelines and protocols that all schools would agree to follow. So I think that was a major component of this, is that while there were some, you know, passionate agreements and disagreements amongst the institutions along the way, there was regular communication, and they weren't 14 separate satellites floating out into space, separate from one another, not communicating with one another. So I think there's that, but then the availability of antigen tests, the capacity of each institution to contact trace and to test their athletes and staff members with regularity, along with the comfort level of the institutions with how the testing was going and how their teams were responding, all of that together, worked its way into the conference making the decision to ramp up football and to be ready to play in late October.
So when are we going to have a schedule?
That's one of those things that sometimes you will find out before the people who actually work here. One thing that has not been so positive is that there have been some leaks from time to time. They're working on that right now. My guess, full disclosure, is that it could come as early as this weekend, if not early next week, as they're, working those things out. It's going to be a compressed schedule. It's going to be fewer games. But we're excited to see where it lands. And, you know, as someone who obviously is paid to say this, so take it with several grains of salt, a team coming off an 8-4 regular season last year, a couple of minutes away from winning a January bowl game for the first time in a generation, with several important returning players back. I'm really excited about the football season and the product on the field for IU, so can't wait to see him play.
All right. Before we leave the topic, Galen, I know that you've been following this very closely in your role at IU, so I just want to give you an opportunity to comment on what you see going forward.
Oh, I mean, it's a fascinating set of circumstances, obviously. And I think I'm happy that the Big Ten and its member institutions feel confident enough in their ability to test and react to things that they can have a season. I think the schools acted out of an abundance of caution in August, but it does appear like things have shifted at least a bit. And so it's tough when you're watching ACC teams and Big 12 teams playing games and you're not. And I think that certainly that'll help some public perception aspects. And I feel certainly good for not just the athletes playing in the games, but, you know, as the director of the sports media program here, I feel good for my students because we were kind of sitting around wondering what we were going to be covering this fall. So it's, I think, a good thing all the way around. And I just hope that the health situation allows things to go through for the entirety of the season. I think it might be a little bit of a rocky road as far as that's concerned, but we'll keep our fingers crossed.
I do know there are probably some people out there saying, well, you know, it's all about the money. And I know I heard Scott Dolson, the athletic director, talk to the Rotary Club last week, and he said, you know, he didn't want everybody to think he was that naive to say that it wasn't partially about money, but that money was not the leading factor involved. So, Jeremy, could you just react to that?
Correct. I mean, regardless of how this plays out, there are going to be substantial and profound financial difficulties facing all of the athletic departments in the Big Ten. While this certainly helps, it doesn't solve them. And I think that's an important thing to note. So this is not primarily motivated, you know, by the financial impact of playing football. I can tell you it has, first of all, it's part of our mission as an athletic department is to actually play games. So it is part of what we are here for. There are some exceptions and those exceptions need to be respected and understood and wholly supported. But for the most part, the overwhelming majority of the students want to play. So that's a huge component of it too. It's part of the experience that we promised when they were recruited as prospective student athletes. And there's also a lot of talk that, well, why football and not everything else? Well, the NCAA postponed the fall championship season to the spring. We'll see how it plays out, but a lot of these other sports are going to start at a later start time. Football is just, it's unique. Obviously, it's unique because of the size of the teams and its outsized financial impact. But it's the way you have to ramp up for a football season is unique to every other sport. So getting that up and running and ready to go, it was the alligator closest to the boat that we had to take care of.
Well, and just to say again what the athletic director Scott Dolson said is, and you've said it too, but the rapid testing and some issues in the heart, some research on the heart and some testing and screening in that area were two of the things that Scott said would help keep the athletes a lot safer, and that gave them some confidence. So I just wanted to mention that in case there were people out there, you know, screaming at their radio that it was about the money. So I want to move to Ken Dauschmidt now. Ken Dauschmidt is the Willard and Margaret Carr Professor of Labor and Employment Law at the Maurer School of Law. And I know that, you know, you've been involved in you've watched this issue of paying players and, you know, whether college athletes should be paid and things of that nature. So if you could just sort of frame this discussion for us about name, image, and likeness, I would appreciate that.
Sure. I'd be glad to, Bob. I should, full disclosure, I actually am, I just happen to be a faculty member on the athletics committee too. So I get to see how our athletic department works and shout out to them that I think they take student well-being and achievement more and make it more important than winning. Winning is important, and our students come here to win, but they do want to take care of these young men and women and give them a good experience while they're here. This whole the current debate over this really began with the O'Bannon case, and Ed O'Bannon was you hear this story enough, and it's apocryphal here now with what's happening with the name, image, and likeness. But evidently, he was playing a video game while he was a famous college basketball player, I believe for UCLA, but I'm not sure since he didn't play for Indiana. But he was playing a video game, and he saw his own image there, and he was struck by the fact that he was not making any money off of the use of his image, but his college and I believe the NCAA were making money off the use of his image. So they sued the NCAA. Under the antitrust laws, basically arguing that the NCAA, in setting up its rules and regulation on the conduct of play, had restricted competition in payments for the use of your image and compensation to the players, without, and it wasn't a reasonable restriction on trade, that it violated the antitrust laws. And about the same time, also, the Northwestern football players organized submitted for an election under the National Labor Relations Act, because they're a private school, and wanted to be treated as employees. And in the course of this litigation, the litigation, you know, spun out over a period of time, but kind of tracking both those possible ways in which players might be compensated, either for the use of their image or as employees, O'Bannon, in some respects, won his case, and the district court said that the NCAA's restrictions on payment for the use of the image were unreasonable and had to be changed. And we've had other litigation since then, the Jenkins case. And the Northwestern football players eventually lost their case, where the board said, basically, we aren't going to take jurisdiction. They didn't say that they weren't employees. And actually, there's a pretty good argument under the National Labor Relations Act that they are employees. But they basically said, we aren't going to take jurisdiction of this because they can't effectively collectively bargain in a conference where they're the only private school. But so we've moved from, if in fact players are going to be compensated in some ways for their image or for their services to the university, we've moved from a model of, we seem to have rejected the employee model, at least in the short run. And we've gone to this model of, well, geez, if the school and the NCAA can benefit from the selling their image, why can't they benefit from it? And a number of states have, the interesting thing was, when people were talking about treating athletes as employees, a number of states started talking about passing laws to make sure they weren't employees. But now, with the use of their image, a number of states have talked about passing laws to allow them to be used for their image. And in fact, I think California, New Jersey, most recently, Colorado, and Florida, and Florida's law becomes effective this next summer, they've all passed laws saying that that student athletes can be paid for the use of their image or can receive compensation for the use of their image. And this really puts pressure on the NCAA to come up with a federal solution, because they don't want this to happen just willy-nilly. Some states, students get compensated, and some states they don't get paid for the use of their image. So the NCAA has decided, okay, we're going to have a standard rule on this. We're going to try to come up with a general rule. They are going to lobby Congress to try to get this rule, or at least some regulation in place at the federal level, so that it preempts independent state regulation. And that's kind of the long and short of how we got to where we are. And that's what they're in the process of doing right now, is developing, the NCAA is in the process of developing its rules. And then they will undoubtedly propose some kind of legislation to Congress too.
I can imagine all sorts of details. The devil's in the details. There'll be all sorts of ways that people will maybe try to get around this, and it's just going to be complicated. So let me turn back to Jeremy Gray and Galen Clavio. And Jeremy, as the coach, you are the co-chair, right, of this committee?
Yeah, that's what I put in the release anyway. Yeah.
Okay. So what, you know, the university seems to be being very proactive for its student athletes with setting up this task force. So what do you hope to accomplish? What's the goal of the task force?
You've already hit on some of it already, in which you don't know what you don't know. A lot of unanswered questions. The devil's in the details. I've heard all of those phrases so far. And that's a big part of it. We know that there's a lot that we don't know yet, that it's going to morph and change and details are going to be coming later. But it's really important that we do know immediately and have a structure in place and people assigned to the task of understanding the rules, understanding the space, and making sure that we're following the rules, making sure that we're educating our athletes, and making sure that we are positioned to be successful with the new lay of the land. It would be like in the early ages of collegiate athletics, hearing that the NCAA was going to be creating rules that everybody would have to follow and then not creating a compliance department to follow the rules. So that is a big part of this task force. And task force is maybe not a great name, because task force sometimes leads one to believe that it's something that's going to meet for 3-4 months to work on a specific problem, then go away after the problem's resolved. This is going to be an ongoing operating unit within the athletic department. And it's important that we understand those issues. So that's a big part of it. Another part of it is educating the athletes so that, one, they know the rules, but then they also know the opportunities. And then what's especially interesting to our coaches is understanding how we are going to be able to use it to recruit prospective student athletes. How do we portray Indiana as an institution, to prospective student athletes, to let them know about their opportunities if they come to school here? So handling kind of those three buckets are what the task force has been charged with.
So just to follow up, I know, we're talking sort of the 60,000 foot view, but on the ground, one of the things I read this morning has to do with, the NCAA has list of potential changes for student athlete activities, including advertising and promotion. And they're talking about things like, if an IU or any other tennis player would want to give lessons, the tennis player could be paid for the lessons. Or if somebody wanted to be paid to sell their autograph, they might be able to be paid to sell their autograph. They're a college student. So, these are some of the things that could happen, on the ground, that I'm sure those are the kinds of rules that you're going to want to look at. And then the other one, and Galen, this is particularly relevant to you, social media content creation and distribution. And I know, from your experience at the media school, I think you'll be probably pretty involved in that.
I will see. Yes. I mean, my background and my research area is specifically the intersection of social media and sports. And I think that what's fascinating about what that particular paradigm presents in terms of the way that communication operates is that, 25, 30 years ago in the mass media era, you had a very small number of media channels. You had your newspapers, you had radio stations, you had television, and those were controlled by, traditional media entities. And now you look at the growth of, Instagram influencers. You look at the growth of Twitter feeds and the way that people are accessing those for their day-to-day information. And it presents just it's a different reality. And you can look across the world of social media, and some of the most popular people on the planet on social media are athletes. The people like Lionel Messi and Cristiano Ronaldo, and the stars from various sports that have a global reach. A lot of NBA players fall into that category as well. And so, I think that what that's demonstrated is that there's value in a person's name, in their likeness, in what they, how they represent themselves. And there are people that are looking to those folks as conduits of information, conduits of entertainment. So, I think that who knows where this will go yet on the collegiate level, but we're doing a disservice to athletes, to people who are college age, if we're not teaching them how to act online, how to present themselves online, and how to leverage the power that they have for their own gain, whether that is professional or financial or both.
Galen, can you talk a little bit about the kind of stipulations that you think need to be in place for student athletes as they're going to be engaging in really business ventures?
Well, I'm taking a very open view of that. And I think a lot of what we're seeing with the debate about name, image, and likeness right now comes down to the heart of the debate about the concept of the student athlete. There are restrictions that are placed on student athletes that aren't placed on regular students. And that goes across the board. And those are NCAA imposed items. And the NCAA is, you know, the collection of schools that comprise it. So, you know, my perspective on it is, I'd like to see, some kind of an explanation as to why restrictions for athletes at the collegiate level should be more so than what the restrictions on an average college student would be, because there really aren't any there. Now, where you get into a lot of murky legal background, and certainly Professor Dauschmidt would be able to better explain this for me, is where you get the branding of the individual institution, like an Indiana University, and how does that conflate or interact with the branding of the individual athlete? And that's not really my particular area, but I think it's certainly a very interesting thing to think about as we move forward, because a lot of these things could be mutually beneficial for the institution and for the athlete. And it's okay, how do you combine those two items, and does that lead to a larger reevaluation of the whole paradigm?
Ken, do you want to react to that?
Sure. I think in the O'Bannon case, what the NCAA argued basically was that, so you're absolutely right that there currently are not restrictions like these on ordinary students, and the question is why have them on athletes? And in the new guidelines, the NCAA is talking about only having differences if they're really necessary for intercollegiate athletics. But I think what the NCAA would argue is the reason why athletes are different, at least for some of them, the magnitude of the money is going to affect it, so that it affects their experience on campus. It affects whether they are perceived as amateur athletes. And then also differences in the ability of different schools to reward people for the use of their image it would make the playing field for intercollegiate athletics imbalanced. And as a result, they would argue that it's necessary to have at least some restrictions on this to preserve the amateur status, to preserve the athlete's experience as a student on campus rather than, you know, basically a celebrity on campus, and also to kind of level the playing field. Now, they lost that part of the O'Bannon case, not completely. The judge didn't say that they couldn't have some restrictions. It just said that a complete prohibition on it was unreasonable. So we'll see what they come up with.
We're talking about athletics today and the idea that student athletes would be able to use their name, image, and likeness, and how they might be able to use name, image, and likeness to receive some compensation. We have Jeremy Gray, Senior Associate Athletic Director for Strategic Communications and the Director of the Cuban Center at IU, and he is the co-chair of the IU Athletics Name, Image, and Likeness Task Force. Galen Clavio is Director of the National Sports Journalism Center, and he is also on IU's Name, Image, and Likeness Task Force. And you just heard from Ken Dauschmidt, the Willard and Margaret Carr Professor of Labor and Employment Law at the Maurer School of Law. If you have questions or comments for us on this topic, send them to news@indianapublicmedia.org, or you can follow us at Noon Edition. Well, I think one of the leading issues, and Jeremy, I'm sure you'll be able to relate to this, is you know, how do you allow a student athlete to use and be compensated for their name, image, and likeness to promote a commercial product or service? You can think about, I won't name any current student athletes, but let's just think about, you know, a year or two ago when Romeo Langford was here. If he comes in as a freshman, he's got this big name, and all of a sudden he's got a deal to promote one of the Chevrolet dealer in town. That would seem to be something that he might be able to do under these rules, but it seems like a real slippery slope. So, you know, how do you think that will play out?
That's a terrific question. I would say when it's been portrayed in the public discourse, there's often the example of maybe the local car dealer will pay a Romeo Langford while he was a student here to be in his or her television commercial promoting a product. But when we started putting together our task force and figuring out who would be a good fit on the task force. And by the way, Professor Dow Schmidt might end up being on our advisory board with his expertise in labor law after this. Yeah, you might have gotten yourself drafted to help out here. But when we started thinking about the task force, we really believed that the space where a student athlete would be able to maximize their value would be in social media. They're often called influencers, but the ability to promote things in their social media channels with the wide reach that they would have, that would maybe be their best opportunity and the most consistently utilized opportunity in the name, image, likeness space. We got to figure out what those rules are, make sure we are following those rules. But you could imagine a world, and I want to get it out of just basketball and football, where I think a lot of schools are going to be focused on that. At Indiana, Fred Glass coined the phrase 24 sports, one team. Well, I think we're taking that holistic approach when we're thinking about these issues. Think about Lily King when she was an undergraduate after capitalizing on winning her gold medals. What would she have been able to do as a social media influencer to maybe, monetize herself in the name, image, likeness space? So I think social media is going to be a big avenue for student athletes to potentially profit off their name, image, and likeness.
That's a great point, because IU has a lot of Olympians, and those are individual athletes that, for at least a shining moment in time, are really well known and written about all over the place. So, Sarah,
we've gotten a couple questions, and Jeremy, this one might be best for you. But the question is, how will the NIL rules alter? How will that affect athletes who rely on scholarships, and will it possibly promote more equality?
That too is a great question. One, I don't entirely know. One, it will have no impact on their scholarships. So the scholarship is a guarantee that we make as an institution. Each sport, this might not be widely known, has a specified number of scholarships. And not all of them are round numbers or whole numbers even that are allowed to be given. I believe like baseball has 11.7 scholarships for 35 players. Kyle Schwarber, as great as he was not a full scholarship athlete when he played here. There are others that are full scholarship, sports. When you're thinking of, women's basketball, men's basketball, the 85 scholarships for football, it will have no impact on their scholarship. As far as equality is concerned. Thinking about the Kyle Schwarber example, obviously he was one of the five best athletes that we had in the entire decade. My guess is with his social media reach, he would have, and just his general presence, he would have been able to monetize himself to match the amount of money that he was not getting in scholarship to be able to fund his college education, and maybe even having more money left over. I'm thinking of someone like Tyra Buss when she was an athlete here, with her enormous popularity and her prodigious following on social media. I bet Tyra Buss would have made some pretty good money under the rules, in the name, image, likeness space. So I think a lot of the athletes would have been able to get a different level of value while they were here, had those rules applied back then.
Hey, Galen, can you help me out as one of our older listeners, older hosts? How is money made in this space? I mean, how much money are we talking about? And how could a Tyra Buss have made a lot of money in the social media space?
Well, I mean, the numbers are all over the place, and I think a lot of it comes down to the audience level that you've got. The example I always use, it's an out there example, but it's like people have heard of Ninja, who's the esports gamer that's monetized his brand to the point where he's making seven figures just off of his social media presence. Now, I don't know that you would necessarily have your college athletes have the kind of pull across, different areas that they would be able to do that. But you can, whether it is through monetization of an individual feed, through interacting with a company that's local or something beyond that, or whether it is monetizing off of, say, commercials off of a YouTube channel. I mean, there's a lot of different ways to do it, and it can certainly vary quite a bit, largely based upon the audience and the overall draw that you have with the people that are trying to be reached. And I think one of the interesting things about this is, a lot of people don't realize, especially with college athletes, that many of them have already built something of a social media presence before they get to college in the first place. I mean, I've done some studies where we've looked at high school football players who, through the process of being nationally ranked and, through the process of getting attention from various media outlets, are carrying 5-6 figures worth of audience into college and then are able to build off of that. And so that ends up changing the scale a little bit, because if more and more people do that, then, you almost have to get to a higher plateau to be able to generate revenue at a high level off of what you're doing.
So we've had a few questions come in. Some are about this topic. We did get one about the Big Ten reversal. And I guess I do want to just try to paraphrase it. And it basically talks about, having the student athletes being able to play football, and they're calling it an entitlement of being able to be tested, routinely, when not everybody can go out and get a virus test every day. And he suggests, are we willing to sacrifice the lives of those who are not of celebrity status in favor of entertainers? And how does the university justify that? It's a tough question, but Jeremy, I want to give you an opportunity to.
I actually have an opinion on that.
Oh yeah, Ken, go ahead.
We should let Jeremy too, but I thought about that because I've seen that argument made, and I don't think it's a very good argument, because these athletes are undertaking a little bit of special risk, and we can make it safer. They have to be in close contact with people every day for their practices and their games. And we can make it a little bit safer by this instant testing. The other students are spread out. They're at least 6 feet apart in classrooms. Not only that, anybody in the county can get a test anytime they want. I've been tested twice, either at the university or through the county facilities. If a student wants to be tested, whether they have symptoms or not, they can get tested. It's just, we're not requiring them to get tested every day. So I actually think that's not a very good argument.
Okay, Jeremy, I'm going to let you off the hook. I'm going to go to a different comment that we had and just, again, get your reaction to this. But someone said he could have sold so many Tim Priller T-shirts when he was here. He could have made serious money in Bloomington for 4 years. So Tim Priller, very popular athlete, hardly played.
But I think it touches on an important point. One, we need to understand the scale of this. The idea that hundreds of athletes at each institution are going to be able to, in a meaningful way, monetize this opportunity, I don't think that that's accurate. It's going to be a relatively exclusive group of athletes, but it's also going to come from places you don't necessarily expect. Two of the top 10 athletes in social media following in the NCAA are not in a revenue sport. There's a softball player, I believe, from Oregon, who's got like 1 million followers. So it can come from unexpected places. And two, social media is a skill. I mentioned Lily King, but I think we need to mention another gold medalist from the same Olympics who went to Indiana, and that's Cody Miller, who is making 6 figures a year vlogging. He makes his own videos. They're humorous in nature. It's not Steven Spielberg level production, but he makes his own videos. And he is sponsored as a professional swimmer by, several people in the aquatic space. And he is making a very handsome living because of how effective he is on social media. So it might not be the third best player on the men's basketball team who's able to effectively monetize it, But Tim Priller, because of his personality, might have been an athlete who could have successfully monetized it. So it might benefit athletes coming from unexpected places. So I appreciate the Tim Priller shout out, but realistically, he could have been one to have taken advantage of it.
All right. We have about 15 minutes to go in the program today. If you have questions or comments, please send them to news@indianapublicmedia.org. And you can also follow us on Twitter at Noon Edition. I want to get back to one of those real fears. I know, you know, Jeremy, I mentioned the Romeo Langford might be able to sell cars, that kind of thing. And I think that, you know, one of the fears has always been, it seems to me, with the NCAA, that a school could recruit kids and say, hey, if you come here, I can guarantee you, you know, X amount of money in whatever, in name, image, and likeness. And it would give some schools a recruiting advantage. So, you know, in these laws or in these regulations, how is that going to be avoided, where some schools could take advantage of a situation and perhaps run afoul of the spirit of these new rules?
I'll let Galen take a swing at this too, because I know he has strong opinions on the subject. But I would say the following: no matter what the rules are, there are going to be institutions that don't follow them. And I would say similar things have been proven to have taken place with the existing set of rules. I think it should be noted that our task force, there's only one unit of the athletic department that has more than one person on it. And that's our compliance department. We've got two people on the task force from compliance. It's very important that we follow the rules at Indiana, and it's our number one stated goal as an athletic department. But I can see people running afoul of the rules. Two, the question about larger institutions having an inherent advantage in this space compared to smaller institutions with less reach. Well, that already occurs. Alabama's got a larger weight room than Ball State. They just do. And I think those advantages are going to play out in a similar way to the way that they're already playing out. So the idea that Kent State gets to show the same things on a recruiting visit that Duke basketball does, I just don't think that that's reality. And I think this will be reflective, you know, going forward too.
Yeah, I'll jump in. You stole some of my points there, Jeremy. But it's because it's a very common misconception, I think, that there's this mythical even playing field in college athletics. There's just not. I mean, the Indiana University is, well, I think the athletic budget is in the, what, $125 million range. Ohio State's is $210 million. There is a significant competitive disadvantage there. And Indiana's, I think, 25th in the country in athletic budget in a country that's got, you know, about 130 FBS level athletic departments. So within this, I think there's always going to be questions of, you know, who is able to utilize this the best. And as Jeremy said, you're going to have people violating whatever set of rules are put into place. We've seen that throughout the entire history of the NCAA. And it has often been used as an excuse to deny student athletes the same rights as other students on campus in terms of being able to make money, not just off of their athletic endeavors, but off of other pursuits that are outside of athletics that they could potentially monetize. And it's one of the things about this name, image, and likeness revolution that's taking place that I like the most, which is that it is giving athletes at the college level a chance to empower themselves a bit more and to start learning some of the lessons that we want them to learn. And even if they're not making huge amounts of money, the incentive of being able to build something and based upon who you are and what you can do. And you know, I think that's an important lesson, an important thing that we should be teaching at the college level.
Quick follow to that, Galen. Do you think, though, that this has the potential to exacerbate the sort of inequities that exist between athletic departments?
No, I actually think that in some cases it'll act as a bit more of a leveler, because what you're going to have is certain institutions that are going to be more upfront with trying to make this area work. And, you know, the schools that I've seen that have announced task forces in this area, you know, it's the TCUs and the Rutgers and, you know, smaller athletic departments in some cases, or athletic departments that maybe don't have the same level of you know, build out that say a Texas or an Ohio State or a Michigan. I mean, there's an incentive for some of the athletic departments a little further down the budgetary pecking order to take advantage of this and to make sure that athletes know that they can come there and take advantage of it. So I actually think it could have a little more of a leveling out effect than anything else.
We got a question from Twitter that I think maybe Kenneth, you can answer the best, but the comment was, this is complex. I'm third team all state. So I can go to IU and sit on the bench or attend a local university and collect endorsements as a hometown hero. Is that a correct interpretation of it, you think, Kenneth?
I think that's absolutely right. And that maybe makes the last point. It's a nice segue from Galen's last point that in some ways this will be leveling because if you can be the hometown hero, that might be worth something. But if you sit on the bench at the big, if you're the little fish in the big pond, that might not be worth anything. So that's true. There are other complications that are going to occur with this. I know the schools are already talking about, you know, how whether they can use the school name or logo, and I think it's pretty clear they don't want them to use the school logo. Also, what if the school has a contract with Nike, but the student wants to make a contract with Adidas? What do you do in those situations? And then you've got certain standards the schools are going to have to put in. We probably don't want them endorsing, the student athletes endorsing absolutely any business. I know people have talked about prohibiting them from endorsing gambling, online gambling and things like that. You can imagine, you know, strip clubs or any kind of other thing. And then when we get to these influencers, I haven't heard this talked about much, and I don't understand the influencing as much as Galen. I'm an old man on this too, but one way to become popular on the internet is to be outrageous or notorious. And I mean, I think the schools will do a good job with this. I think that most of our student athletes will do a good job with this, but as a lawyer, I know eventually someone is going to misbehave. And then the question is what kind of rules are we going to have to prevent someone who acts outrageous online in order to get followers and it demeans their school or something. I mean, they're not only going to have to regulate who they can endorse, they're also going to have to regulate kind of conduct in seeking revenue.
Yeah, I think about, you know, Dennis Rodman, if he was a new recruit for IU and how you would control his behavior. He was a pretty notorious, outrageous kind of guy. So,
I mean, Dennis was kind of the outlier to the outliers, to be fair. And look, I mean, I think these are good points that are being made, although I would point out that you already have, you know, people constantly monitoring athlete social media. Jeremy can correct me if I'm wrong, but there's a whole process that college athletes go through when they start, where they're workshopped on what to post and how to utilize social media. And I think that, you know, that process is just going to continue, but a lot of it comes down to educating students and college age kids in general about how they use social media. One of the things that I talk about a lot in class is, you know, most teenagers utilize social media as almost like a private communication channel. And then they also will consume certain types of entertainment that they enjoy. The transition most of them have to go through, and it happens right at this level, is transitioning from having it be something that you just do between your friends or between your peer groups to something that is public and that is visible to everybody. And, you know, so it's all education, and it's all, you know, being willing to allow some mistakes as long as you're able to correct them and show people what is acceptable and not acceptable behavior from a social perspective. And I think that that's part of this whole process that we're going through, not just with this committee, but just in general with social media.
I want to piggyback off of that. We were the second school in the country to partner with Open Doors Ready. It's a service that works with the NCAA. They also have arrangements with the NFL, NBA, MLB, Players Association, the PGA Tour, the ATP for tennis. they're a real leader in this space, and they're going to provide each student athlete with an in-depth analysis of their social media health, featuring personalized insights, evaluation of their social media name, image, and likeness. There's going to be all sorts of education going on, from benchmarks to tools and personal planning. Student athletes will receive education emphasizing the opportunity and next steps in the process of maximizing their value. That's going to be a huge component of the task force, is to help open doors, help our athletes, you know, be operating with best practices on social media. And yes, some of that I read directly off of our press release there.
Well, and I think that brings up the point. This is how the best schools are going to respond, that IU is going to help our student athletes not only make sure that they follow the rules, but also that they get the full benefits of this, right? And that's the way we will use it for recruiting, which is within the rules. And that will be the best practices.
So Kenneth, can you address how the NCAA has been able to control whether students entered into third-party endorsements all this time?
Yes. I mean, if you want to, you can ignore NCAA rules if you don't want to play NCAA sports. But because they're a sports league, they get to make certain uniform rules. And actually, Oklahoma v. NCAA, there is a Supreme Court case a long time that established that college sports, league sports, is a unique product that can only be made with certain unifying rules. And they are an exception to the antitrust laws to the extent that those restrictions are reasonable. Obvious restrictions would be every football field has to be 100 yards. You have to have a lineman and a judge and a referee, whatever, all the standard rules. Those are easy to say. The NCAA can require everybody who plays NCAA football to follow these same rules. What gets harder then, though, is when they start regulating things like what kind of scholarships can you get, what kind of compensation for food or housing or whatever. When they start making rules like that, now the question is that really a reasonable restriction? Is that a necessary restriction in order to produce this league sports play? And courts, as I said, with the O'Bannon case, at least, the judge thought that they did not need to completely prohibit payment for the use of their image.
Yeah. And a question from Twitter, I think this is probably best for Jeff. Will athletes be made Twitter official, and will the university have control over that?
Jeremy, is that who you were directing that to?
I'm thinking of verified profiles is what they're saying, like the blue check marks. We already work to get certain athletes the verified blue check mark. By the way, a lot of them ask for it. Really, that is more up to Twitter, Instagram, the platforms themselves on approving them as a verified account. It's actually not as easy as it used to be to do that, but I think that would be separate from name, image, and likeness. That's something that's been going on here for years. In fairness, it's so that there are not fake accounts or parody accounts made on their behalf as they become, you know, notable public figures. It's to protect the athlete as much as it is to make them look awesome on a social media platform to be able to monetize it.
So in our last few minutes, Jeremy, can you talk about what's next for the committee, what how you're going to progress, what kind of timeline you're on?
Yeah, so we actually had our first meeting last week, and the first meeting we actually had compliance just go over all of the rules as they stand now and where the NCAA stands on these issues. The next meeting, which will be next week, we will have our federal relations staff with the university tell us about the national legislation, different bills that are going through Congress or being brought to committee in Congress. I think right now it's educating the task force, and then we'll get into the brainstorming fun part of it later on as we go into the fall and get ready for January. But right now we're in NIL graduate school, trying to learn all we can about the rules, the policies, and the different places that it can take us.
Will there be student involvement, the student athletes themselves?
This was a hole in the co-chair's plan. In the first meeting, I think within 3 minutes, Galen, somebody asked if we can get a student athlete involved. So, yep. So we're in the process of finding some, you know, interested student athletes to be involved in advising the task force. So yes, there will be student athlete involvement.
All right. And you mentioned FBS before, which is the football bowl series. Now there's Division I and Division II and Division III. Are the rules going to be the same for the three divisions in the NCAA?
You know, Tip O'Neill said all politics is local. I really haven't paid attention to how it'll impact anybody who's not in the FBS. So I don't know. I would imagine it would be the same.
Okay, so last question, you know, and all three of you can have a shot at answering it. I mean, where do you hope that this is in, let's say, a year from now? We're through COVID, everybody's playing again. You know, what do you hope the student athletes have the ability to do at that point? And Ken, can we start with you?
Well, I guess I don't think this is a bad idea. I think it is fraught with potential problems, like being abused in recruiting, or that students somehow being taken advantage of in this. But I'm hoping that they will be able to receive reasonable payments for reasonable use of their image. Given how much money there is now in intercollegiate athletics, at least men's football and men's basketball, that seems a fair thing to do.
All right, Galen.
My hope on this is that we have a robust, multi-leveled process that we're using here at Indiana University that becomes the model for how the rest of colleges and universities engaged in athletics handle this, where we're providing training and development assistance to students who are in athletics so they can help develop their social media profiles, because some, as Jeremy mentioned, are very good and very much natural in this space, and others are perhaps not particularly interested in it or suited for it, and that's fine. And then I hope that we have a system that allows our athletes to essentially try to leverage this as best they can, both for what they're doing right now and what they plan to do professionally, whether that's in athletics or not.
Jeremy, we have got about 10 seconds.
I co-sign what the other two said. I really hope it's a great opportunity for our student athletes in the same way that Olympians of the last generation have been able to enjoy, similar benefits.
All right. Thank you very much, Jeremy Gray, Galen Clavio, and Ken Dow-Schmidt. For producers Bento Boutier and John Bailey, for engineers Matt Stonecipher and Mike Pashkash, for co-host Sarah Whitmire, I'm Bob Zaltzberg. Thanks for listening.
Noon Edition is a production of WFIU Public Radio. A podcast of this program is available at wfiu.org/noonedition. Production support comes from Smithville, fiber internet, streaming TV, home security, and automation in southern Indiana. More information at smithville.com. And from Bloomington Health Foundation, this September hosting the virtual 21st running of Hoosiers Outrun Cancer, a 5K run/walk supporting those in the community facing a cancer diagnosis. Registration and more at HoosiersOutrunCancer.org.